This show is part of the Electric Agora network of podcasts.
Crispin Starwell, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, Dan.
All right. Welcome to everyone in the Sophia audience. I'm here with fan favorite and personal favorite, Crispin Starwell of Dickinson College. Crispin, before we get started, just because people have been following our careers, tell us what's going on at Dickinson. Are you going back? You think you're going to be back fully normal in the fall? Are we still going to be? What are they saying to you?
Yeah, fully normal in the fall with vaccine requirement for students anyway. And actually, we're changing presidents, college presidents. We seem to have pulled out of our budget crisis, including COVID budget crisis, and suddenly things are looking up a bit at Dickinson College.
So this didn't cause a huge tuition loss. It hit us hard, man.
Right. As much as anything, our problem has been declining enrollments over several years, dramatically. You know, very small classes, and they managed to fix that. At least for a year. So I don't know, man. But yeah, there's a structural deficit that has to do with COVID and a bunch of other stuff. But
yeah, because we, COVID, being public, don't really have any sort of endowment. And so if we have big drops in tuition, I mean, we just go into the hole. And COVID, the COVID year, we had a serious decline. But I guess you didn't have such a serious decline in enrollment. You were already had a decline in enrollment, that you didn't kind of feel the COVID in that sense.
It put a further pinch in the budget, and all these people deferred or took leaves and things like that. Yeah. So it was in there, but anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're going back. I hope we're going back full. The problem is that in Missouri, especially in Springfield, they are not going to implement a mandatory vaccination regimen because this is Trump country. And these people don't believe in no darn vaccinations. You know, we have only 30% vaccination rate, which I wouldn't be surprised if we have an outbreak in the late summer and wind up having to go back to lockdown again. I mean, the people here are so bovine and stupid that they really believe all the shit that Trump was pumping into the ecosphere for the last 4 years, and there you cannot reason with them. I mean, you try to point out, hey man, every single one of you got fucking 15 vaccines when you were a baby. What's your problem, right? They just start quoting all sorts of crazy shit that they heard, you know.
Right. Whatever. Although, you know, it is kind of the Trump media system or something, or info system. But Trump himself didn't go radically anti-vaccine.
No, he got one himself.
Yeah, man. He set up the programs.
Ivanka, right? Like, tweeted herself getting vaccinated. I don't know. I don't even know what to say anymore. But anyway, so I'm tentatively hopeful, but I also could see it going wrong. Indiana's requiring full vaccination, so my daughter is going back full. I'm just not so sure about us, but we'll see. I mean, we'll see. All right.
Well,
so
pray it'd be okay, because I've had,
You've had enough. You had about enough of it.
I had enough Zoom teaching and things like that. Yeah.
All right. Sure. We're here to talk about an essay that I'm about to post. I haven't posted it yet. This was one where I wanted to do another edit after we spoke, because I'm not sure. This is exploratory. So, and it was inspired in part by something you'd said to me at the end of a dialogue that we did on the Prolegomena for Pluralist Metaphysics about addiction. And you thought it was sufficiently disruptive of my picture of action that I'd presented that I thought, okay, well, I better go think it through then. Because if Crispin thinks that it's vulnerable in this way, I should look at it. And so that's why I did. Crispin's read it, but I haven't published it yet. It will go up at the same time that the video goes up, so people can read it. Crispin, did you say you wanted me to start by just reading a section of this, or do you want to read a section of this?
Well, you want me to read a couple paragraphs of this, I guess, just to get it going?
since you're going to ask the questions and push, why don't you read the parts that you want to start with?
Okay. Well, as it sits now, I guess, you know, you might be revising this and stuff. This is the second and third paragraphs.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm fascinated by all of these questions, and I'm going to admit that I'm conflicted and sort of personally embroiled in them in a way that worries me a bit, like in terms of like how clean I can come at them philosophically, particularly addiction.
I should add one thing. My main stalking horse is not addiction. It was the paper was inspired by your comments on addiction, but my real stalking horse is at a much more generic level of, can you do something that you don't want to?
Yeah. The weakness of will problem.
Well, but that strikes me as having additional baggage, don't you think?
Okay. Okay.
Anyway, go on.
Right. Although, you know, your position is Socratic, yes, in some ways, right? Like,
that's a fair thought. I mean, it might be, on. Yeah.
Which is not to attack it in itself, of course. Okay. This is you, Dan. There's a certain line of thinking that has been part of the Western narrative since antiquity, one source of which is the Pauline letters of the Christian New Testament, and especially the letter to the Romans, quoted above. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Which is really a classic that is driven like centuries of theology and stuff like that.
That's why I quoted it. I figured go for the big, yeah. The big target.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I have felt that though. Vividly, like when I read that, I go, oh fuck, me too, you know. But anyway,
man, oh
bro, me too, man. Take a puff, man, you'll feel better. Anyway,
hey, I wrote this while taking puffs, man. I mean,
medical puffs, I'm medical.
That's right.
And especially the letters of the Romans, which can be traced back even farther to Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. I'll refer to it as the weakness of will tradition. And it goes something like this. I can want to do something and yet wind up doing exactly the opposite. Actually, this is not quite like a Socrates position, is it? It's no. It's not that, yeah, it's not a matter of just knowledge.
It's not about beliefs or knowledge of the good. It's about wanting something and doing something that affects the opposite of what you want.
Yes. Is that possible? That's interesting. It's not exactly the akrasia question, I guess, as usually.
No, it's not actually. That's why I'm.
Yeah, that's not.
That's why I don't want to talk about free will too much, because I don't actually think that that's what this problem is.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I do something without wanting to, or while wanting not to, you know, as an action, right? Like, in Christianity, this weakness is taken to be as being metaphysical and endemic, a legacy of the so-called fall of man, and only resolvable via divine intervention, like by arbitrary grace, let's say. In contemporary addiction discourse, it is taken as being, which I really think you're right to connect with these Christian themes, actually. Like, I think AA really, however consciously or not, emerges real directly from these kinds of questions, actually. It is in contemporary addiction discourse, it's taken as being sufficiently beyond most people's ordinary means to overcome as to require extraordinary intervention. The most rigorous of these interventions involve ascriptions of powerlessness that rival and sometimes even explicitly evoke their Christian counterparts. I mean, it does have a kind of original sin quality, and you can't by your voluntary activity change yourself in a way that would make it possible for you to stop or something. I think that's fair. That's fair historically. And then, okay, so I would suggest, however, this is you still, that the tradition leads nowhere but dead ends. and when considered in light of the subconscious and unconscious, is unsustainable. I'm speaking in intellectual terms, of course, that a school of thought or intellectual tradition is incoherent or lacking in warrant need not mean that it is necessarily inefficacious. The claim is not that programs like AA don't work. So that's an important point. And the question, it could work and be false.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, me too. I guess you could have a theory of truth on which it the fact that it works is enough to make it true or something.
If you have
like
a pragmatist theory of truth, I guess, but I don't generally.
No. So for example, to claim that it's not voluntary, that all that drinking or all whatever you were doing, all that gambling, etc., was not voluntary, might remove a burden of guilt in a certain way. Yeah.
There's such a thing as really the Christian. It may be a strategic untruth, right? An untruth that helps you as long as you can sort of maintain it without dissonance, right? I guess it only really works if you actually believe the fiction, right? I mean, it doesn't work if you know it's a fiction, right? Probably.
Although
right?
I think that can get kind of ambiguous. Like you can sort of experiment with trying to believe it and things like that. So, I mean, I guess I do think that there's truth underneath it, and if it works, that's why, kind of. But I definitely want to at least admit that the fact that it works does not entail that it's true, obviously.
Yeah.
I think. Okay. So, all right. Well, I'll hit you with one more. Maybe we could start with the Christian side. This is you again. On the Christian side of things, the fall of man is supposed to have robbed us of our capacity to control ourselves to such a complete degree that divine grace is the only means by which a person can overcome original sin or the fall. Augustine maintained that this grace restores us to our natural pre-fall condition, one in which we are able to act as we intend. But how do we accept this grace prior to having received it? At this point, we are still in our compromised condition. And if we have sufficient mastery over ourselves to accept divine grace, why don't we have sufficient mastery to do good in the first place, in which case grace is entirely unnecessary? If all this doesn't strike you as confused enough, consider that it sets the stage for Calvinist predestinarianism, which represents the gold standard of confused religious takes.
You don't really think a Jew is going to like Calvinist predestinarianism, right?
Hey, I'm of Jewish background, and I find myself very attracted. I think you could feed Jewish guilt in some ways fairly naturally
to
this.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
Let me just say that I've really struggled with this, not only sort of like to some extent as a practical matter dealing with addictions and so on, but also as a philosophical matter about like whether we have free will and what are the conditions of moral responsibility and things like that. But also in trying to figure out what to believe. Like I've been struggling toward some kind of belief in God. I have to say that it sort of narrowed down to the Protestant denominations for me, despite the Jewish background. And
weren't you raised a Quaker?
No.
Were you not a Quaker? I thought I remember that
you
were
a Quaker.
You are a Quaker. Okay, yeah. Quaker.
Yeah.
Well, that's not exactly the most ordinary of the Protestant. I mean, that's one of the more specific of the Protestant, you know.
But, okay, so I was raised by Jewish atheists, I guess you'd say, basically. And by Soren Kierkegaard later on. That might be the reason why I ended up on the Protestant side. And I found myself extremely attracted to this kind of Jonathan Edwards Puritan Calvinist style. I understand why that appears plausible. Once you have God, once you have like a sovereign God in your universe or something like that.
It's not plausible if he's supposed to be a good one, right? I mean, yeah, if you imagine the worst possibly imagine, then yeah, sure, it makes perfect sense. But, you know, I'm just gonna arbitrarily decide ahead of time who's fucked and who's gets eternal bliss. And by the way, tough shit, fuck for you if you're one of the fucked. I mean, that's not really how I normally think of good beings, right? I mean, I'd really have to compare the meaning of the word good and bad to make that become good, right? To the point to where it's almost unrecognizable, right?
Yes. That's another problem.
It's a deranged evil God that does that sort of thing. Not one that anybody would worship in their right mind would worship, it seems to me. I mean, that's why it strikes me as a confused take.
Okay, but that, all right. Right. That takes us out into dealing with the problem.
I don't want to do that. I don't want to talk about Calvinism.
Augustine.
Yeah.
Augustine and Calvin, you know, have a lot to do with that, but,
Yeah,
it's a hell of a thing. And Jonathan Edwards, who I guess is the person I think of on this tip, basically, or having this orientation. It's okay. So what's compelling about it? It seems to me. All right. So yes, I'm attracted to this puritanical style of Protestant Christianity. Actually, Quakerism is quite the opposite. However. It is, I would say it's a Protestant denomination. I guess some of these things might be ambiguous in some ways. But it's definitely a free will affirming denomination.
And pacifistic. And pacifistic.
Yes.
Significantly.
And, and it really emphasizes that you can make moral choices, even heroic ones. Okay. Like you can forswear violence by a conscious decision. Now it might take God's assistance in some way for your conscious decision.
Well, they accept the basic grace framework, right? I mean, and so, I guess what I want to ask you though is, so you find this appealing. So could you answer the challenge that I pose? So explain to me,
right.
If self-mastery is required to accept the grace, then why do I need the grace in the first place?
Right. Okay. Okay. I'm saying I'm attracted to this position, but I reject it. Right. Like Quaker, I'm not taking this position.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. So yes, but I think like on a Jonathan Edwards, you don't have to make a conscious decision to accept grace. That's not up to you either.
But that's the predestinarianism, right? That's what I meant was.
Yes.
So yes, what I'm saying is there's a fundamental instability in the basic Christian setup that the only way to get beyond is to go down what I call this lunatic route, right? This predestinarian route, which I think has 50 other problems that disqualify it that we're not going to talk about. Right. In my view, it's the most deranged conception of a religion that I could imagine.
I find it compelling.
Where we're supposed to be worshiping a supremely good, loving being. It just doesn't, you'd have to redefine what all those words mean in order for it to make any sense, right?
Well, and they did though. I mean, like Augustine defining evil, for instance, right? As non-being or something like that, right? Like there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't want to, I'm not going to try to defend this position. One reason I feel it compelling, I guess I don't feel the same way about myself that I once did. But as like a person in the middle of addictions and with addicts, living, loving addicts and being an addict and stuff like this, this idea that we're totally depraved and unable to redeem ourselves by our own efforts struck me as compelling. Like it strikes me as plausible. Okay. Or it has stricken me at times as plausible.
Would you describe it as fundamentally anti-humanist in the traditional sense of humanism?
Yes.
Okay. Because I'm profoundly humanist.
I guess so.
I'm profoundly humanist, and so I think there's a certain amount of visceral revulsion to these. Yeah. When I hear these views, they actually make me a little sick.
I understand that.
I understand how
that would be true,
which is irrelevant to the discussion. But how do you? Okay, so let's. I want to put away the religious part. Because I run exactly the same argument in the addiction framework. And I want to know where you don't have the appeal to predestinarianism and other sorts of things to come back. Right. I want to hear how you make sense of this in the non-religious context. So what I wrote here is everything involved in attending, sticking with, and embracing the programs and philosophies that are successful in getting people sober involve precisely the agency that the addiction version of the tradition claims that addicts lack.
Yeah.
And what's the answer?
It's quite analogous.
You can't go predestinarian.
Accept grace.
What's the answer?
Right, and you. Right, and it's quite analogous, right? Like to the idea that you have to accept grace. Maybe Jonathan Edwards doesn't say that,
right?
But the 12-step programs do appear to say something like that.
And you have to have enough self-mastery to stick with the programs unless you are forcibly incarcerated into an institution whose job this is. A ton of self-mastery is involved and just sticking with the damn thing, doing what they tell you, so on and so forth. But I thought you don't have any self-mastery. That's you're constantly repeating that you have no self-mastery. It seems to me you've got a ton of it, right? It's the program is predicated on you having it, even while it's telling you you don't. That's the problem I have with it.
Well, the program is definitely predicated on something like, okay, your sponsor telling you that tonight you've got to write down a list of all the people you have harmed. And then like say a series of prayers to try to become willing to make amends to them.
Right.
And expecting you to do that. And usually the person in that position will do that. And if they don't, then something has gone wrong. Sponsor might get pissed off, you know, or whatever, et cetera. Like it does appear to be a series of intentional actions. That's true. I mean,
this is not a gotcha point. I'm trying to understand the fundamental. If all you tell me is, look, it's a strategic fiction that AA uses to motivate, then I say, I totally accept that. But I was under the impression that most people who are promoting this stuff actually think this is true, yes. Right?
I take it pretty seriously.
You have disease myself. Models of addiction where it involves no agency at all, right? I mean, it involves no intentionality at all. It's like having epilepsy, right? Now, that can't be right, right? It can't be.
Well, one thing... One thing that's strongest about the theological version, or one thing that's centrally expressed in the theological version of this kind of total depravity, original sin, arbitrary grace structure, is humility. So, the basic claim is like, I can't figure this out. I don't have the power to change myself or my world. So I need a higher power to change myself or my world, or there needs to be if I'm going to be changed, it will not be by my own agency or something like that. See, I think that's what Jonathan Edwards or John Calvin thought they were expressing. Like, God is sovereign in this universe and I am not much. I'm not a center of power. I'm tempted to think I am. But that's actually where my problems are coming from, or that's where my sin is, or something like this.
Can I ask you a question about this in the addiction context? Is it generally the presumption that addiction is in part a product of hubris on the part of the person?
It's certainly the idea that hubris will be exacerbated or make treatment more difficult, I guess you'd say.
Because I was under the impression that the profile of addicts is actually self-loathing, not hubris.
Yeah, and maybe it's a certain kind of cultural person, like a person with a certain kind of cultural location that in meetings, you'll often hear that alcoholics are egomaniacs with a self-image problem. Hmm. You know, that kind of thing, like really conflicted around these things, like incredibly arrogant often. But see, this has changed, I think, like you know, since AA was sort of designed for a bunch of white guys, kind of, maybe it was sort of white guy problems in some sense. But yeah, okay, so, but that maybe speaks also to the why this would be partly effective, because it might be that a certain kind of humility is required in order to undertake treatment, you know what I mean? Like, or to just even to make the decision to go to treatment, because that decision seems to indicate, does it not, that you cannot stop yourself, right? Like specifically when I say, if I make a decision, I'm going to go, I'm desperate here, I'll try a meeting, or I would like to go to rehab. It's not exactly a decision to stop, right? It's a decision, it's partly an admission that you can't make the decision to stop. But it does seem to indicate that you can make decisions that might lead you to be able to make a decision to stop, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm also very open to the statement that, hey, look, the people who are writing and producing this sort of addiction theory, let's call it, they're not endeavoring to be philosophically rigorous in the ways that you're going to expect. In other words, you're going to have to accept that, yeah, certain things that they're saying, they don't mean it the way if a philosopher was making an ontological distinction would mean it, right? I'm open to that, right? My essay is, yeah, purely on the assumption that this is meant earnestly, it's not just a strategy, right, and that it's supposed to be philosophically, hold up to philosophical, have philosophical muster, right? If neither of those is, yes, the case, I have no objection. I mean, this, I am not stalking, right, Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not, right, my aim, right? I mean,
right, right. I'd like to defend this in part philosophically, though, or at least see to what extent it can be. I'm interested. I mean, because I'm worried about having hypocrisy along these lines, or doing things I don't believe, or you know, making statements I don't agree with, or something like, yeah, that. But I mean, okay, so just the. If you just want an account, for example, of how someone gets to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's not an account that involves just kind of decide, I do not want to drink anymore, and then taking actions to realize that goal. I mean, I'm not saying that that's not in there in some very general way or something. But I mean, the way that it's portrayed, say, in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you reach a quote unquote jumping off place. Like, you reach a point of total desperation where it's like, you know, drink another quart of vodka and die after having lost everything already. Or like, just try to crawl to the door of this place. Or just let the people that are telling you that you have to go now to this place take you to that place. Like, I don't know how much of a, I think it's really varies. Like, some people walk in just off the street with that, seemingly not having gone through like a insane, an unbelievable, you know, personal, economic, relationship, everything crisis. But I guess the way they portray it in AA is like, you get to this point where it's, I mean, maybe it's just your impulse to live and like getting to the point where there only seems to be one possible way to keep crawling, sort of, you know, or something like that, you know?
So I did a little research on this, and something like half, or maybe even a little bit more than half, of people who quit do so with no program whatsoever. So I what I'm curious about is, what is your sense of what's the difference between the person that has to go, that if he doesn't go to AA is going to drink the quart until he's dead, and the person who quits or returns to healthy consumption without any program at all? What's the difference between those two people, do you think? What sort of would you find in the profile that would be different in those two people?
Well, I guess my belief, and I guess I have absorbed a lot of 12-step, But my belief is that if someone is an alcoholic, they cannot return to normal ingestion.
And you think that that categorization is an objective matter of fact about a person. So you're going to wind up saying all those people who quit without, they were never alcoholics to begin with. Now you do realize the trap that you're setting for yourself, at least philosophically, right? Philosophically, that's not going to be sustainable, right?
Right. No, wait.
That's a no true Scotsman fallacy, right?
Okay. Yes.
Obviously. All
right. That's not what I'm saying, though.
I quit drinking. No, you didn't. You were never an alcoholic to begin with. All right. Well, whatever. Right.
No. I've known people who quit by themselves, and I've had times when I'm quit without like being deeply involved in a program right then and stuff like that too.
Or I used to drink too much and now I don't drink too much, but I still drink. I mean, you know,
That's where I'm rejecting the alcoholism diagnosis. Though I admit that this is like a bit of a dogma that if you can drink normally, if you can drink moderately, having ever gone through any process, then you were never an alcoholic, is my opinion. And that's definitely what AA teaches. Now, I do think that there's all kinds of processes you could go through that might cause you to stop that wouldn't be like, necessarily a social program or something like this. Maybe you could read the literature or get a kind of spiritual, a spiritual experience through some other, I think it is possible. I guess what's really very typical of a lot of alcoholics I've known is that we can decide to stop drinking, decide not to drink tonight, and not drink tonight.
But you can't drink two drinks.
Right. And maybe decide never to drink again, but drink again. You know what I mean? Like, so, right. And there does seem to be, I guess there's some kind of physiological.
So the guy who finds, you know, maybe I'm describing somebody I know. The guy who finds that, God, you know, I'm just having a little too much scotch. You know, I woke up kind of fucking a little ragged. I got to keep it to two. Right. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And then that's what I do. That's not an alcoholic.
I feel not.
Okay.
That's why you're saying I'm just trying to define the problem away. But I guess I've just heard a lot of alcoholics talking about trying to do that and not being able to do it. You know,
and the ones that are able to do it, you then say are not alcoholics.
That's true.
That's the problem I have with it, right? I mean, telling me it's just a sort of a strategic fiction, okay. But if you're telling me that I'm supposed to take this like seriously and think of it as passing philosophical muster, then I have to say it doesn't. I mean, it just walked right into one of the most obvious fallacies, the no true Scotsman fallacy that, you know, you hear people trot out all the time and it's never acceptable anywhere else. So I don't know why I would accept it here.
No, wait a second. It is one of my criteria for counting someone as an alcoholic that they can't do that. They can't drink moderately. And it's one of the kind of AA type of criteria. Now that doesn't. And so I tend not to count someone as an alcoholic if they can do that. But that's not to say that you couldn't empirically, if you had some empirical way of figuring out who is an alcoholic and who is not, like if there's some kind of genetic test or something like that, or neurological test of any sort that would show that. I mean, let's say it's an empirical hypothesis, but it's one that I believe, I guess. It is part of how I define what an alcoholic is.
Right. But I've had doctors tell me that if you drink more than two drinks a day, you're an alcoholic. I mean, and I actually had a very funny exchange because I said, well, by that definition, the entire countries of Italy and France and Spain are alcoholic. And you know what his answer was? This isn't Italy, Spain, or France.
Yeah, yeah.
What he didn't realize, though, was that meant that it's not a disease. It's a culturally described phenomenon. Yes. In other words, that's why I said in my essay, I'm actually starting to think that addiction is not even a medical term at all. It's a political and an ethical term, right? It's a term that belongs to a different frame of reference. It's not like the word, you know, cancer, or like the word, you know, heart disease, or like the word, you know, it's something that describes something that's heavily socially inflected. Because if you told French people they were alcoholics because they had two glasses of wine a day, they would tell you you were fucking insane, including their doctors would tell you that you're insane, right?
Yeah.
My doctor was a teetotaling Baptist and told me that, right? I laughed in his face. He was so upset because I just threw the France thing at him. And he said, this is in France. And I burst out laughing. I had to change doctors because I couldn't take him seriously afterwards.
Be nice, man.
I mean, like, you know, like, I'm just like, dude, man, you're really confused. But what all well, my point things- just is that, you know, you have a definition, but that's not necessarily the ones that either AA is using or that the medical establishment is using. For all I know, there's five different ones. And how would you tell me which one is the right one, right?
All right. Okay, and I've been writing about the, for example, the DSM psychological diagnoses as a whole. Yeah. And addiction is one of those, isn't it? And yes, actually, I should be quite sympathetic to the idea that these have all these kind of political, social, relative content, like what it's how it's appropriate or normal to drink.
They're normative.
Actually, somewhat different.
They're normative. Yeah. They're not straightforwardly factual.
Right. Well, but it's funny though, because I feel like it is kind of factual on the, I mean, let's just take alcoholism or addiction, substance abuse style addiction. I mean, I don't know what to think about, say, gambling addiction, sexual addictions, things like that.
How about food? Because I gave the example.
That's an interesting problem.
I gave the example of overeating, which is the one that I've had a lot of.
Yeah.
And I tried to talk through what the phenomenology of it seemed to be. And I wondered what you thought of that relative to other addiction narratives that are more traditionally held within addiction narratives, like drinking, smoking, drug taking.
It's fascinating because all these things raise somewhat different questions, right? Different kinds of questions. Like, you can't live without eating, but you can live without gambling.
And
you know what I mean?
You can live without drinking booze also.
I mean, like, they're quite different, you know, and, you know, or sexuality and sexual behaviors, like,
would you not think of habitual overeating in the same frame as habitual overdrinking or habitual over cocaining or whatever? I mean, like,
I guess I've known people in OA, Overeaters Anonymous and stuff that seem to get a lot out of a 12-step model. It's a substance abuse in some way. It's similar to alcoholism in that sense. And more like alcoholism than it is like gambling in that sense. Like, there is something you are putting in your body and you're changing, you know, your actual chemistry and stuff like this in various ways. You know, I don't know that I'm not comfortable folding all this into one simple model. Though.
So it may be that
as tempting as it is.
So it might be that my recounting of that is not entirely apt in terms of the larger discussion. Because what I was trying to do is think about what habits are. And I think that a habit is something, the reason for which has gotten so well established that it's sunk into the unconscious and it seems like you're acting on autopilot, but you're acting under the guidance of a reason. It's just, you've done it so many times and the reason is so well established that you no longer countenance the reason anymore.
But what if
counter reason comes up, that's when you start to see the reason again, right? So I begin to realize, oh, wait a minute, I do want to eat late at night. That's why I'm doing it, of course. But what's happening now is more and more I'm wanting to feel a little more uncomfortable in my clothes. I'm starting to get sick and tired of not being able to wipe my own ass, and it's starting to build. And so what's really happening is two competing desires.
Yes.
There's no mystery. It's not addiction. I've not fallen off the face of man. It's just competing desires, man.
Right. And you know what? I think that probably as an initial move, should see how much we can do with that, right? Like, in other words, and because it's completely plausible. All right, like, so I'm sitting there. It's 1990. I'm drinking quite heavily. I have small children in the house. I've started my first job, okay? I'm remembering my dad, the alcoholic, who was just a complete, you know, failure as a parent and things like this. And it's driving me crazy and shit. Now, I have, and I want to save my marriage and stuff like this. I don't want to have these secrets and shit that I have from people, et cetera, et cetera. I have all these reasons, and I'm aware of at least a good subset of the reasons. And I have, and, but I also want to drink. And I actually do have reasons there too. Like, I want to change the way I feel. So I need to relax.
Why do you accept the lack of agency model? I mean, what you've just described is a struggle between conflicting desires that is the human condition, right? I mean, that's the human condition. It would be very nice if all of our desires aligned and pointed in the same direction, but they don't, right? And so I guess I don't understand then what you just said is what I think, right? So I don't understand then why you get, other than for strategic reasons, why embrace this? No, I'm drinking and I don't want to. I'm just acting with no motivation and I can't help it. Like, why would you then think that that's the right way to frame, given what you just said, right?
Right. Well, I was trying to make the position that I wanted to attack plausible. I was trying to state the position.
Okay, yeah,
but
yeah,
I'm not actually, I don't want to attack that position simpliciter because I do think that's a normal human condition. I mean, that's a normal human condition. I also think though that maybe in this case particularly, it gets to the point where, well, I mean, can you have a habit that continues after all the reasons have gone and you know that, for example? So I guess I felt like by the time I did, like, I had years on end in which I had such I, and what is I here is a little bit of a problem too. Like, what's making the choice between these desires and stuff like this, or which to pursue? But I had years and years where it seemed to me like I have every reason in the world not to drink. I have 60 excellent reasons not to drink. And 3 bullshit reasons that I'm fully aware are bullshit that I'm drinking. That I'll still run one of them as I gulp, maybe, you know. But it's like after a while, it starts to feel not true that I'm just in a complex situation making decisions.
Can I just stop you on that?
That sort of feels like.
Can I stop you on that?
Yeah.
Why does it become no longer plausible because of how intensely it feel the struggle feel? Is it? I'm trying to get a sense of why, what causes you to then shift you to a different model? What about the phenomenology of? Is it that it just hurts so much, the struggle? Is it that you just wind up so frustrated with the struggle? Like, what is it? I'm asking.
The reasons
for a reason.
Are so inefficacious. Yeah. It, because all of my rationality and all of the most compelling reasons I'm generating, which are true reasons too, by and large, are inefficacious. Like, I can keep stacking up more stuff and have every reason in the world corresponding to a set of desires that are also very powerful, right? You know, to have this good life, or to have a reasonable future, to maintain my marriage, to keep my job, and all that kind of stuff. And all that doesn't work. It's not enough. And so then I start to feel like I'm not really in the realm of reasons and,
Reasons and ends. You're no longer in a reasons and ends game, which means you're kind of out of the traditional action framework. The reason I'm asking is, I'm just thinking of.
I mean, it's confusing though, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking of. The reason I'm asking is because I'm thinking of things where I'm profoundly conflicted in my desires. I feel the conflict very intensely, And not only have I not resolved it, I don't see any hope of resolving it, but not in this frame, in a different frame. And I just wouldn't think that you would employ this frame. So I want to know why you're employing this. So let me give you, tell you what it is, right? So here's my current most tormenting conflict. I want to do everything I can to make my parents' last days as pleasant as possible. I also desperately, desperately want to have as little to do with them as I can, because yes, every moment I deal with them, I am in agony.
Yeah.
Right. I'm in mental anguish every time. Just seeing them makes me sick. This will not be resolved, Crispin. The way it's going to be resolved is that they're going to die. That's the way it's going to be resolved.
Yes.
And even then afterwards, it would probably will have ripple effects afterwards. Now, this completely strikes me as a very straightforward clash of desires that point in opposite directions. I yes don't think it's resolvable. It's yeah tormenting.
Yes.
Why is this not an example? In other words, I want to know what's distinctive about the kind of conflict you're talking about that leads you to conclude that we've now entered a point where we're not talking about agency anymore, or conflict, or tormented conflict, but something else entirely. That's what I'm interested in hearing you maybe try to talk through. What's the difference, right? I can't stop wanting to help them, which means I can never be at peace, right?
Right.
But I can right also not stop wanting to protect myself, which means I'm always trying to do anything I can to hold them at an arm's length, right? I don't believe that's resolvable. Yeah. I don't believe it's resolvable.
Right, I agree.
So what's the difference? Yes. What's the difference?
Well, so how do you describe the situation you're in? It's just that, helping you to think of it?
The way I describe it is having a fundamental, profound, and devastating conflict between two very strong, equally merited, opposite pointing desires. That's how I put it.
Right. Right. Well, but the addiction case that I was describing is one in which one of these desires far outweighs the other.
But that's what I'm getting at. In what sense? Because why yeah couldn't I just say to you, look, you obviously really fucking like drinking.
That's true. Yeah. Well, it becomes less and less true. You know, people enjoy their crack less and less as they go on, I have to say.
Depends on what you mean by enjoy, though. But, I mean, I do address this in yeah the essay where I talk about, this issue of sort of, you know, that there gets a point with habits where you can only reasonably ascribe the desire after the behavior, not prior to it, right? So in other words, yes, I don't really know if it makes sense to say that you don't want to drink when you're drinking that strongly, right? What do you mean you don't want to drink? Of course you do, right?
Well, it does make sense to say that you don't want to have that epileptic fit, but you are. And so then the question is, what's, you know, it's not exactly like that, but it's also not exactly like, you know, reaching the decision, okay, so now I'm going to fly to visit my parents, you
yeah
know?
Yeah. So what you were going to say is that you're not acting.
How is it helping?
You're not acting in this sense.
How is it helping you? Will it help us explain what you do to stipulate that you always do what you want to do? Like, so what could we conclude about you in your dilemma with your parents? Well, we can conclude that whatever you do, it was what you wanted to do. Well, now how much content does that have? First of all, is that merely a stipulation? So like, if you see me swallowing some alcohol and just infer from that raw fact that I must have wanted to do that, because people only do what they want to do or something, I'm a little worried that that's an a priori stipulation rather than something that emerges from like how the actual experience of trying to deliberate in these complex situations or.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I mean, I like the framing of this as what are the advantages, disadvantages, uses, non-uses of taxonomizing these things in these various ways. That's a very fair question to ask. And I try to, at least in the essay, show why I'm doing this. And that is because if we don't have some intrinsic connection between wanting and doing, that I don't see the way that we distinguish actions from events. Right. I don't see how we distinguish hailing a cab from a muscle spasm that causes your arm to do exactly the same motion. And if you have a way of doing that, that doesn't involve the intrinsic connection of wanting and doing, I would accept it. In other words, I have no person, I'm not wedded to this. This primarily comes from my effort to try to make sense of the difference between actions and events.
Right.
And that's important because of normative considerations.
Right.
Right. We don't treat muscle spasms normatively. We do treat hand raisings normatively, depending upon the reasons for them, the ends they accomplish, and so on and so forth, right? Punching somebody in the face, we treat normatively. But if you have an epileptic seizure and hit somebody, we don't treat that normatively, right? Precisely because of a certain taxonomy. Well, we don't, as a matter of fact, Crispin. We just don't, right? You don't go to jail for it. You don't get morally condemned for it. You don't get any of those things, right?
If you have an epileptic seizure. Well, if it's a sheer spasm. Perhaps, yes. A sheer seizure case.
But that's what I mean. So, I mean, how do you distinguish actions from events without an intrinsic relation between doing and wanting?
Well, I'm not saying there aren't relations between doing and wanting.
Intrinsic relations in actions, right? How do you distinguish actions from events without it?
Okay, so you distinguish actions from events by A, you know, this thing that this person's body performed is an action, just if it was
an action is
what
a motor
they wanted.
An action is a set of motor movements that have intentional direction and content.
And I'm so it's not just a matter of what.
I'm neutral about how you treat that, right? So you could treat that like the way Wittgenstein does, as essentially fundamentally a social thing. Or you could treat it the way the reductive materials do and say that there are representations in chemistry. I don't care how you do it. All that I'm saying is that what distinguishes an action from a motor movement is content.
Okay, I got you. And that requires, so it's not just a matter of like having the desire to get a cab.
It's representing a set of motor movements a certain way.
Exactly.
Having them be represented by others in a certain way with a surrounding understanding of aims, ends, and what counts as success or failure. None of which is present in the muscle spasm.
Right. I got you.
Even though they may be identical motor movements.
Right. I see. Right. Yes. That's a classic problem, of course. The difference between
raising my hand and my hand raising. That's Wittgenstein, right? What's the difference between my hand raising and raising my hand? Wittgenstein says nothing. If what you mean is something inside it, but everything, if what you mean is the interpretation of it, right? Everything.
Right. Okay. So I guess what I'd start out by doing is saying that most things that human beings do are somewhere in between consciously raising your hand, having the thought, I want to get to X. What's the best way to get to X? Take a cab. How do you get a cab? You raise your hand out here on the street and a cab stops, you know, like a paradigm of intentional action and just a muscle spasm where you have Tourette's or something and your arm goes up and a cab stops, let's say.
Right. Right. The cab would have made a mistake, like, right? That he wouldn't be making if you were hailing him, right? And I don't see how to explain that without intentionality. I don't see how to explain that difference without intentionality.
Right. Okay. I guess I would try to make some moves in that direction. But initially, I want to say, say you hail a cab every day in New York City.
Okay. Go on.
You know, like, and you know, in some sense, your arm just goes up. You know, like, you don't engage in a whole series of representations. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, your account allows for this kind of case, like a habitual.
Right.
But somewhere the reasons still lie. But, or for example, you're you know, you're walking from location A to location B. You want to get to location B. You know, maybe you have perfectly rational reasons to want to do that and everything. Most of what you're doing, however, is not encompassed by that purpose and stuff. Like the motor movements you're making continuously, you know, as you step with your left hand, left leg, step with your right leg, pump your arms, avoid the fire hydrant. You know, like most of what you're doing is basically unconscious and is basically unintentional.
That's interesting.
It does, a lot of it does have moral content, though.
That's interesting. You almost sounds like you're saying once you break the action down to its constituent movements, the intentionality vanishes, is what you're almost sounds like you're saying, which is really interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
I'm still permitting the intentionality right here to be driving the action in some sense. But what I'm saying is like everything that the action itself, or the physical event itself, is massively in excess to the purposes, the representations. You know, like every representation you might make of the future state you're trying to achieve is liable to be like, first of all, way sketchy. Like in terms of content, it's just like something,
a vague notion,
utterly vague or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess I would just start
a half-baked, like, a half-baked idea, yeah. Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, well, my approach to answering the question of how I would distinguish actions and events is I would start to try to break down the distinctions. I mean, and also with the value judgments, okay? So, for example, I think there's plenty of data that makes the other way on this, for example. Let's say someone is habitually unaware of their surroundings. Okay, they just don't have a very good sensory awareness of their surroundings, and they're extremely clumsy too. And they trip into you again today in the park.
Yeah.
Are you angry? Do you think they're responsible or whatever? Yeah.
That's something I would probably have complicated feelings about it, and I would want to think it through, right? I'd want to say, okay, to what extent do I think that these are really kind of involuntary movements? And even if they are, given that he knows he's prone to them, to what extent is he doing whatever he can to not run into everybody?
Right.
So I guess it would be very complicated, but at the end of the day, it would come down, the ultimate assessment as to whether I blamed him would come down to his intentionality. First of all, are these even actions, or is this really like a poor guy with epilepsy having seizures on everybody? And B, is he doing in the meta level anything to mitigate the impact on everyone of this, right?
Okay.
But I mean, I'm not denying that. Let's maybe frame it this way, and this is probably the last thing we can do because we're already an hour and 15 minutes, but let's frame it this way. We can always do another one. Let's frame it this way. I'm inclined to say that reasons pretty much are solid and remain intact. What ebbs and flows is awareness of them. That's the sub.
Okay.
And the more habitual something becomes, the more it ebbs into the back of awareness. What's the advantage to treating it as on a gradient instead of being A or B, but simply the awareness is on a gradient? Which is the way I'm inclined to treat it. In other words, I'm treating it epistemically. You want to treat it as part of the phenomenon. What do you think is the reason for going that way rather than the way I've done it?
Well, I think the way you're doing it is plausible too. But I began to worry, like, okay, so now we're stipulating all these unconscious reasons.
Or semi-conscious, stuff that you're vaguely aware of.
Semi-conscious.
If you pay attention, but then it kind of sinks back when you're not paying attention, you're just kind of going through the motions. That's very common, right? I mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
So is that an intentional action or not, right?
Yes. Like, yes.
Okay, so how would I detect my unconscious reasons, or how would other people detect my unconscious reasons?
Usually,
how would I know that I'm acting for unconscious reasons rather than for no reasons?
Through your behavior.
Okay, so all right. So I think you're just stipulating that there's a reason behind every behavior.
Well,
it, right? I don't think that's an empirical hypothesis.
But I would say it's more than a stipulation to the extent to which we all have so much familiarity with our reasons sort of receding to the back of our awareness as things become more habitual. In other words, this isn't just like some ad hoc stipulation to solve a problem, right? This is something I would argue that everybody experiences on a daily basis.
Right.
And again, it's not a stipulation. It is a result in part of my effort to taxonomize reason, actions and events, right? But I don't think it's just like, well, come up with some random thing to accommodate a problem. It's more like, well, we have to distinguish actions from events for all these other reasons. And by the way, we have an awful lot of experience of things that we were very conscious of the reasons for, that as they became more routine, the reasons sink back. But it's not that the reasons go away and now it's not an action anymore. It's just that the reason now you just kind of aren't really paying much attention to it. But it can be brought back to the forefront, as in those cases like of conflict, like I'm talking about, right? I mean, as I began to feel more and more physically uncomfortable from being fat, my reasons for eating became apparent to me again, right? They kind of came because they were now again a topic of discussion, internal discussion, right?
Right. So, well, how would you show you hadn't lost reasons and then regained them or something like that? Like I do think you're stipulating that if you're acting, you know, there must be reasons, even if, for example, they're unconscious reasons, they've receded, maybe you're not in a position to reconstruct them anymore.
Yeah.
This kind of stuff. Like at that point, I'm going like, well, am I acting for reasons or not? And how would I show that? I can't do it by self-examination, that's for sure.
Right.
I could, you know, because I'm not transparent to myself in that way.
Right.
You know, but look, like, say I'm playing a song, like improvising a song on the harmonica or something like that. Is every note appearing for reasons? I mean, like, I just think most of what I do, first of all, has nothing to do with reasons, but, you know, but on the other hand, if you could reconstruct a picture in which I played D flat instead of F sharp because I wanted to achieve a 12 bar blues structure or something like that. I don't know, man, but I think it's excessively cognitivist. I don't think that we're organisms, man. We act like dogs act, man. We lack like,
yeah, but I don't know that the fact that we're organisms establishes or changes very much. It's simply because what I'm going to say is we are organisms with incredibly complex structured brains with huge capacities for exactly the sort of representation that I'm talking about. You know, when you ask me about stipulating, I mean, I think that's a fair thing. I mean, look, there is at some point a place where if I'm not stipulating, I'm falling back on a definition, right? The question is whether of action versus event. The question is whether the definition is just stipulated on an ad hoc basis or whether it has a reason. And so I guess that what I want to come back to is, look, and it's what I said here, I take that the concern with excessive and destructive drinking to be fundamentally different from the concern we have for people with epilepsy and Parkinson's. And it seems to me reasonable to think that that difference is precisely the difference between action, the difference between a concern over an action that involves representation and ends, right?
Right.
And something that's just mere...
But that's under debate, right? Whether alcoholism is more like epilepsy or more like reading yourself to sleep at night. You know what I mean?
Is it really a matter of debate? I mean, other than within a very specific, let's say, advocacy community, are we generally prepared to say that addictions and things are no longer topics of normative investigation?
No. No, we should. But there are also
topics. I mean, if it's like epilepsy, then I don't see what there's to talk about.
Right. Okay, so there I think
it should not really be some agonizing, some agonizing moral problem that families that destroys families. I mean, families may get destroyed by epilepsy just because of the sheer pain and suffering of dealing with this. But not, it's there. What I'm saying is that there is a different kind of concern that suggests that this is a different kind of phenomenon, right?
Right, but it's at stake right now too. to what extent should we blame addicts? Okay. What I admit is, like, dealing with addicts, you're having all kinds of, moral judgments, and they make sense. Okay. Like, in other words, and it's not clear to me, which dimension we should be assessing this in. Definitely the biochemical research is in there somewhere. No, like, absolutely. It's not decided
That's not disputable. Absolutely not. No, I agree. I mean,
right. So the question, it's not like epilepsy, because this movement of the arm with the glass is not involved. It's not a twitch. It's not a reflex arc or something like that. But now what the biochemical antecedents of it are, and I think might be a really complex question. It might be a really complex question in a lot of cases, but I do think it's an open question. And is it basically a biochemical twitch, or is it basically a series of intentional actions? But that does, as you say, it affects the moral weight or reading, at least to some extent, of these things.
It sounds to me like you want to locate this actually in between epilepsy on one side and my habitual overeating on the other. You want to put this in between them. And the reason, I guess, that you might want to is because there does appear to be, with regard to the traditional addictions, a suspiciously difficult, it's suspiciously difficult to negotiate the competing desires. In the case of my overeating, it wasn't easy, but it certainly was clear that once the desires that stemmed from the discomfort of being so large and the increasing fears as my age advanced being so large, I could almost feel them beginning to match up to the enjoyment of the eating. I could start to now, and I never really entirely quit. I simply reduced late night eating to a level at which I could lose weight, but I still do it now and then, right?
The habit matters, right?
And what you're saying, though, almost is like, yeah, that's the case that's most amenable to your Kaufman's intentional analysis. The epilepsy is the least. The problem with drinking is it's kind of in between. Yeah, there are these reasons, but God, are they stubborn, right? They just don't move, at least for some people, right?
That's the way it seems to me. And also might be midway, even in biologically speaking, in the sense that, there's some kind of genetic predisposition. I mean, I guess I sort of believe that too. Yeah, like, well, it runs in my family really bad.
Hasn't that been established pretty well?
I think so, maybe, yeah. I mean, I don't know if they've identified the genes and stuff like that, how far that's gone. But it strikes me like, it runs like hell through my family.
It runs in families very strongly, like generations worth.
Right. So, I mean, at least in the classic addiction cases, I think it's plausible at least to think that there are these mid-range cases. And then we have to... And it really is a question like how much to blame an addict for their addictive behavior or the behaviors that their addiction drives. I think we're in kind of a cultural crisis about that. Well, it's a complex matter.
I'm actually I'm very unhappy with the blame game. Like, I really don't think that it's productive. I think it's often cruel and sadistic, because it's not like the person is happy about what's going on, right? I mean, and you're already miserable and you're just putting the boot in, so to speak. I mean, I really dislike that whole thing. I was actually thinking about it the opposite. It seems to me that those that are involved in helping the addicts employ a lot of normative encouragement. It's not the way you talk to an epileptic.
That's true. That is true.
You talk, you try to convince the, part of the reason why you need to stay in here. Don't you care about your children? Don't you want your relationship with your wife? Blah, blah. The epileptic, that's not the conversation you're having, right?
Right.
Which tells me that it's much more like other things in which we try to exhort and implore people to their better angels. But I appreciate the fact that the philosophical taxonomies may just simply fail to describe what you're describing as a more gradiated radiation, right?
It could be that actions and events interact complexly in most like human affairs, kind of, right? That or it's hard to sort out in some sense, or
I think that's right. Anyway, we should end. It's an hour and a half. My well is dry. I've kind of told you everything I wanted to say, and I think you've told me quite a good of things in response.
That's probably true.
So anyway, I wish you a good summer, a healthy summer. Both of us are dealing with parents. Both of us are dealing with parents in elderly stages. So I wish us both luck in that regard.
Take care of yourself, as you said earlier.
I'm trying. And I'll see you in the next one. All right.
All right, man.
All right. Take care, my friend.
Enjoy this.
Ciao.